Reading is from James chapter 4, beginning at verse 13, which can be found on page 1217 in the Bibles on the chairs. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil, so whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasure in the last days. Behold, the wages of the labourers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned. You have murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brothers, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth, or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes, and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation.
Thank you, Jim. Please do keep that open. We won't actually get to verse 11. We'll leave that till next week. So the verse about swearing. Sorry, verse 12. You'll have to come back next week for that. I think that's just a typo. If you're here for the first time, there's an outline in your service sheet of where we're going. You may find that a help to turn to that as well as to keep the passage open. And if you want pens, I think someone can circulate pens if you like taking notes. As they're doing that, I just want to begin with a straw poll. Don't often do this as I begin a sermon, but put up your hand if you are wearing a wristwatch at the moment. Okay, hands down. Put your hand up if you're not wearing a wristwatch. Okay, interesting. Thank you. Hands down. Pocket watches came on the scene in the 16th century, but the first wristwatch was produced by Patek Philippe in 1868. And then wristwatches became really popular in the 1920s. And nowadays, I was going to say hardly anyone is seen without them, but certainly some Bard's people obviously haven't fallen for that one. It's a bit like mobile phones, isn't it? That apparently there are now more mobile phones on the planet than people. And yet it's only a few years ago that going to that red box on the corner was thought to be quite sufficient. Thank you very much. And now everyone, pretty much, apart from Bard's folk, have a wristwatch. And we're more aware than any previous generation of the time, that wherever we look, we've got the time being displayed. Whether it's on your wrist, or if you haven't got a wristwatch, it's because it's on your mobile phone. And then on your computer, it's down the little right-hand corner box. And, you know, you listen to the BBC News on the radio in the morning, and they're constantly giving an update on the precise time, aren't they? Saying, you know, it's now 26 minutes to 8, and we're going to have a summary of the news by James Nock. And you think, well, why do I need to be constantly reminded of the time? In the Bible, we find that it is vitally important to know what the time is. Not in the sort of micro wristwatch sense, but in the macro salvation history sense. That is, it is vital to be aware of the period of time in which we live. So where we and our lives fit into that. So, for example, in Romans 13, verse 11, it says, you know the time, that the hour has come. And time there doesn't mean 6:35 in the morning. It means where we find ourselves on this timeline of God's purposes in history and in eternity. Christian magazine a while back asked me if I'd write an article for them on time management. And so I a little bit cheekily sent them an article on Romans 13 and on this biblical perspective on time. And the editor decided it wasn't quite what they were after, you know. But, he said bitterly, this biblical perspective on time is actually much more important than the sort of time management stuff that you can pick up in any business book. I mean, sure, it is important to manage our time well. And, you know, all of us feel the pressure. We've got too much to do in the time available. You know, how do we juggle all these competing priorities? And getting to things on time is important. So it's an expression of love for other people, isn't it? And reliability, that we're punctual. But having a biblical perspective on time is even more important. And it's something which runs through the section in James that we're looking at today. So James 4:13 to 5:11, it's divided into three sections, as you'll see in your outline. And the thread running through them is this biblical perspective on time. If we lose track of time, if we lose track of time, it can have serious consequences. I remember years back when I was a curate, so an associate minister, I was sitting in my study up in Carlisle, which looked out over the road. So I was there at my desk and I suddenly saw this funeral cortege driving past down the road. And it made me think, that's interesting. I'm taking a funeral today. And it's at 1 o'clock and I checked my watch and it was 5 to 1. I thought, that's the funeral that I'm taking. And so I donned all my clerical gear that you had to wear on these occasions, and I streaked out of the house like a caped avenger and managed to just get to the church doors as the cortege rounded the corner of the road and started to come up towards the church building. I'd lost track of time. But losing track of time in this biblical sense is much more serious. In his letter, James has put before us three hallmarks of true religion. And if you've been here through the series, you'll know what they are. So caring for the needy, controlling our tongue, and keeping ourselves from worldliness. And it's this worldliness theme that James is continuing in this section. So if we lose track of time, biblically speaking, what worldliness might we fall into? Well, firstly, you'll see on the sheet there, godless planning in 13 to 17. So verse 13, if you just turn back to that page, 4:13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Sounds a bit like James has been overhearing a conversation between some business people. Whether they're Christians or not, we're not told. But there's nothing really unusual in their plans. So they're about to go off on a business trip. It's all been arranged. You'll see the departure time is set. So today or tomorrow, you know, the morning flight out of city airport. Destination into such and such a town. So maybe off to Paris. Length of stay. Spend a year there. You know, maybe working for the office out there. And then the purpose to trade and make a profit. You might think, well, what's wrong with any of that? Is it wrong to make plans? No. Is it wrong to make a profit? No. So what is wrong with it? Well, verse 14 tells us, yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. That verse echoes Proverbs 27, verse 1, which says, do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring. None of us knows what tomorrow will bring. We've no idea what's around the corner, so tomorrow you may be made redundant, or you may fall seriously ill, or you may die. Verse 14 says, what is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Life is so short, it appears and it disappears. We're here 1 minute, we're gone the next. We're like the morning mist that we've seen plenty of here on the Isle of Dogs over this past week. So our lives are here in the morning, but then gone by the afternoon. Just this past week, one of the mums, one of the Christian mums at our kids' school, was told that she has terminal cancer. She's in her 40s. She's got two young kids. a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. And even if you make it into old age, it's soon gone. So what should be our attitude in the light of this time perspective? Well, verse 15, he tells us that instead you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. You see, who knows what tomorrow may bring? We certainly don't, but God does. God does. He knows what day you'll die. He knows what each day will bring. He's in control of that. Not even a sparrow falls to the ground apart from the will of the Father, we're told. We are finite, God is sovereign. And so we need to live humbly. And we need to make plans humbly, acknowledging that God is in charge and we aren't. If the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. It's a perspective which shaped the life of the Apostle Paul. And so to give you some examples, I didn't put the references on the sheet, but Acts 18, verse 21, when Paul leaves Ephesus, he says, I will return to you if God wills. Romans 1, verse 10, he prays that somehow by God's will, I may now at last succeed in coming to you. 1 Corinthians 4:19, he says, but I will come to you soon if the Lord wills. 1 Corinthians 16, verse 7, he says, I hope to spend some time with you if the Lord permits. And the writer of Hebrews, Hebrews 6, verse 3, he says, this we will do if God permits. Now, isn't it striking how conscious Paul was that he wasn't in control? I mean, sure, he had hopes, he had dreams, he made plans, but it was always within this framework of understanding that the Lord was in control, not him. And sometimes he states it explicitly, but I take it that it was always there in his attitude. And submitting himself to God's will, wanting God's will to be done, as Jesus said, your will be done. And so in that sense, we could say that all of Paul's plans were made in pencil. They were provisional. If it is God's will. But notice that these people to whom James was writing had a very different attitude. So if you look at verse 16, he says, as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. That is the problem with the planning they were doing in verse 13. Pride. Boasting in your arrogance, he says. So what James is taking issue with is a proud attitude which assumes that I'm in charge of my life. I make plans. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. When I determine it's my life, I'm in control. And such boasting, James says, is evil. It is godless. It's leaving God out of the picture. And it's completely out of touch with reality. It's forgetting the time. In control? Really? You don't even know what tomorrow will bring. You could be dead tomorrow. The essence of sin is to live life as if I'm in charge. So before we become Christians, our attitude is basically, I wear the crown, I call the shots. And that proud attitude is expressed in our planning. We've got our life all mapped out. We'll study this, we'll get that job, we'll live there for so long, make so much, buy this, buy that, retire over there. It's my life. Yeah, I'm in control. I'm the master of my fate, I'm the captain of my soul. And all our little electronic gadgets can reinforce this illusion that I'm in control. So, you know, at the touch of a button, I can call up whoever I want from wherever, and I can see what I'm doing in, you know, 4 months' time. And James is saying, wake up. It's an illusion. You're not in control. God is. And none of your plans will come to anything unless God permits. He's the eternal rock. You're a passing mist. And so if you're wise, you will acknowledge that and submit your life to him. You'll be familiar with Shelley's famous poem, which vividly captures what an illusion it is to think that in your pride you're in control. You remember this traveller comes across a broken statue in the desert sands, and the poem ends like this. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. But if we're Christians, we also need to beware this godless attitude. It's all too easy, isn't it, for us to slip back into living as if we're in control. You know, we've got it all mapped out. Life in the fast lane, making decisions, you know, planning our lives, controlling the world from our BlackBerries. Do we ever stop to say, if God wills? Christians used to. They used to say that. They used to even write it. They'd put DV for the Latin Deo Volente at the end of letters and so on. I guess nowadays, if you did that, it'd be regarded as quaint. You know, I'll be there next week, God willing. Now, of course, what matters most is our attitude. And we don't have to always say it. But the fact that we never say it, it may be a sign that the attitude has vanished. Verse 15 goes on, so whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him, it is sin. So if this is something we've fallen into, James is saying we need to put it right. One area in particular that we may be in danger of shutting God out and becoming practical atheists is our working lives. And that is the immediate setting in verse 13, isn't it? It's a business trip in which God has no place. So the Christian whose faith is expressed at home and at church, but which gets left behind when they go to work. So in our working lives, we need to beware operating as if we are in control. This godless attitude, this proud attitude of, I'm the boss, I'm in control. God is in control there too, and we need to submit to his will. And incidentally, it would be an interesting thing to do, to maybe start occasionally dropping in at work the phrase, God willing, and just to see what reaction you get. It would be a witness to a different perspective on life in a world where people think they run the show. So firstly, we need to beware this godless planning. And secondly, luxurious living. That's chapter 5, verses 1 to 6. Begins with the same call, you'll notice, as the first section. Come now, but this time the call is to you rich. It's very topical, isn't it? Now, with this recent wave of protests around the world, there's been a lot of talk about the rich, you know, the 1%, resentment, anger expressed towards them. On Friday, this past week, the BBC News website ran an article asking the question, just exactly who are the rich? And one Wall Street Journal reporter concluded that people's definition of rich is subjective and is usually twice their current net worth. Protests against the rich, it's not just a modern phenomenon. James got there long before Occupy ever did. Come now, you rich, he says. So this problem of the gap between rich and poor, it was there in the first century as well. And James was among the first protesters. Well, what is his message to them? Well, he says in verse 1, come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. God's judgment is coming. That's the misery he's referring to. It's God's judgment. It's the language of the Old Testament prophets. So Isaiah 13, verse 6 says, wail, same word, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. As destruction from the Almighty, it will come. So the rich may seem to be enjoying the good life, may seem to be laughing all the way to the bank, but James is saying they should weep and wail because of the misery that lies ahead for them. Verse 2, he goes on, your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. Supermarkets talk, don't they, about certain types of food being perishable goods, so goods that don't have a long shelf life. But in the end, this is telling us that all goods are perishable goods, so none of it lasts. None of it will be any use on the day of judgment. Gold and silver, it talks about them corroding. Of course, they can't actually corrode. They can't rust. But the corrosion here is a picture of how useless riches are on the last day. They won't be any help. In fact, did you notice they'll be the very opposite? That these accumulated goods will be used in evidence against the rich at the final judgment. You know, sort of exhibit A, all this stuff is brought in as evidence against them. Now, what's the specific charge here? You know, is it wrong to be rich? Will all rich people be condemned at the judgment? Well, notice there are two specific charges. Firstly, luxurious living. So verse 3 ends, you have laid up treasure in the last days. So what is condemned is laying up treasure. So selfishly accumulating money and possessions and property, rather than being generous and sharing and giving and helping the poor. Verse 5 continues on this theme. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. So these people have lived a life of luxury, life of self-indulgence, with little concern for the needs of others. A bit like the rich fool in Jesus' parable. Remember that guy who just earned more and more and he just designed bigger barns to store it all up for himself. If I was to ask you what was the sin of Sodom, I bet you get it wrong. What was the abomination that was denounced in Ezekiel 16 verse 50? Pride, excess of food, and prosperous ease, but you did not aid the poor and the needy. To live like that, we read here, is to fatten your heart in a day of slaughter. Fattening your heart, it means indulging your passions. And to live like that, James is saying, is to be like a turkey which is being fattened up for Christmas. But the slaughter in this case is not Christmas, it's the day of judgment. God has got a real problem with self-indulgent luxury in a world in which there is so much need. And it's this disregard for the needs of others which is the other main charge. So verse 4, James says, behold, the wages of the labourers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, they're crying out against you. And the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. It appears there that the particular rich people that James had in mind, they were wealthy landowners of his day and they had people working for them. But they defrauded them of their pay. But their unpaid wages were crying out. You remember how Cain's blood cried out from the ground. So these unpaid wages, and God hears. Also in verse 6 he says, you have condemned, you have murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. And the language there suggests a court setting. That they use legal processes to accumulate possessions and property, land, and oppress the poor. So those were the two specific charges. You've got luxurious living and unjust oppression. And they tend to go together, don't they? That where the rich live self-indulgently, it is the poor who suffer. Now, who is James condemning? Well, in the first place, he's condemning the non-Christian. So in the final section, you'll notice in verse 7, he starts speaking directly to the brothers, that is to say the Christians. So it seems that in this bit before, he's got another group in mind, presumably the non-Christian rich people who were oppressing the poor believers. So in the first place, this is a warning to the rich non-Christian. Don't be a fool. If you live for money, if you live for possessions, you may think it's the good life. But a few years of luxury is a poor exchange for a misery of an eternity of misery. So James is saying, look at the time. You know, we're living in the last days. That is to say, the Christ has died, he's been raised, he's been exalted to God's right hand. He's going to return soon. The last days have begun. The day of judgment will soon be here. It's an encouragement as well to the believer to not envy the rich. So it may seem as if the rich have got it all, but they stand to lose everything, all of it, not just their riches, but also their souls. But surely also there is implicit in this a warning to us as believers, that we must beware living such a godless lifestyle ourselves. So laying up treasure, living in luxury, being self-indulgent, and disregarding the poor. We know the time. We know that these are the last days. We know that judgment is coming. We know what God thinks about self-indulgent luxury in a world of such need. And the question is, are we any different in this regard from those around us who don't know the time? Are we letting ourselves be squeezed into the world's mold? So are we living simply? Are we giving sacrificially? Are we sharing generously? As Wesley famously said, earn all you can, save all you can, by which he meant live simply, and give all you can. Will our stockpiled possessions and money, will our luxury goods, will our waste, will all these things actually testify against us on the last day? It's a sobering grid, isn't it, through which to view our bank accounts, our possessions, that if you were to die tonight, would all these things testify against you, or would they be evidence of a life of faith? But in the final section, James does turn to address the believer directly. So verse 7, he says, "Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it, until it receives the early and late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand." At the breakfast table each day, we're reading through Mark's Gospel with the kids. And this past week, we got up to Mark 13. And the bit where Jesus talks about his return. And he says, "Be on guard, be on your guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come." Now I can tell you, time is really precious in our household at that stage of the morning. You know, if those kids are not out the door at 8:20, they're going to be late for school. It's pretty manic. But even as we're keeping our eye on the clock, we want our kids to be aware of this other clock, which is ticking as well. And this other time perspective is even more important than getting the kids to school on time. That they live their lives knowing that the Lord is coming, and he's coming soon. Now, what difference does it make having this time perspective? Well, James says, be patient, like the farmer. So the small farmer in Palestine, he would plant his seed, and he waited anxiously for the rains to come. And his whole livelihood, his whole family depended on that seed producing a harvest. And we actually had a farmer in our early service who was testifying in forum time that this is right, this is what it's like. And so James says, as believers, we're to wait patiently. So we're not to live lives of luxury, but we're to live simply and generously. And we're not to envy those who are just living for this world, because we know the Lord is coming. He's coming, so James says, establish your hearts, that is to say, stand firm in your faith. Don't give way to doubt. Don't give up. Don't become worldly. The finish line is just ahead. And sometimes, let's face it, as believers, we do get weary, don't we, in our faith? And we do get discouraged. And it may be you're feeling like that even today. That just one day rolls into the next and you feel like a hamster on the proverbial wheel. Especially if you're in a boring job. Or if the home routines just seem endless. But James says, look at the time. The Lord is coming, and coming soon. And so this perspective, it helps us to keep going in faith, but it also helps us to keep living godly lives. And so he says in verse 9, "Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door." I'm sure we can all relate to this, that when the pressure is on, as believers, the temptation is to be ungodly. And we turn on others, we turn on one another, we complain, we criticize, we grumble. But when we're tempted to do that, we need to remember the time. The judge is standing at the door. And when the door opens, we want to be found to be those living lives of godliness. I can remember, as I'm sure you can, the classic scenario from school days where the teacher says that he's just going out from the lesson, he's got to go and do something else, he'll be back soon. And, you know, teacher goes and there's complete mayhem that ensues afterwards as people start getting out of the seats and whacking each other with rulers and flicking this, that and everything. And then, you know, 20 minutes later, the lookout says, "Teacher's coming!" And everyone, back to their desks, get their pencils out and so on. And you hear the footsteps coming down the corridor and then standing outside the door, and you know the teacher's just at the door. Well, James is saying the judge is at the door. And if we're being ungodly in some area of our lives at the moment, we need to repent. And so if you knew that the Lord is coming back tomorrow, would there be some area of life that you'd want to sort out today? So maybe a relationship that you'd need to give up, or a relationship to sort out. An activity you'd need to stop. Now, some sin you'd need to turn from. The judge is standing at the door. There's no time to lose. Now, yes, in many ways, the life of faith is the hard road. It's the rocky path. And we all know that. But we're not the first ones to walk it. Many, many have gone before. And they are encouragements to us to keep going. And so James says in verse 10, "As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast." The Old Testament prophets, what examples they were. What a high price they paid for their faith. But they kept going. They didn't give up. And what an example Job was, as Andrew's already mentioned. So verse 11. "You've heard of the steadfastness of Job and seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful." So that guy Job, he kept going, didn't he, in the face of enormous suffering and testing. And God brought good to him in the end. Very wealthy guy. But he was a guy who used his riches generously, caring for the needy. And so if we keep going in faith, we will inherit the good as promised in the end, in the age to come. And so these heroes of the faith, these guys who have gone before us, they should encourage us to keep going. But we won't be like them unless we have this perspective on time that James is talking about. Now, I've never done this before, apart from in the early service, but I wanted to give something a quick go, which is to make a phone call during a service.
And 10 seconds. At the third stroke, the time from BT will be 7:22:20.
There we go. That's the speaking clock. Don't know if you've ever done that. 1, 2, 3, if you ever get bored. do ring it. Apparently it came about because of the English obsession with precise timekeeping. And this modern one is accurate to within 0.005 of a second. You know, whoever needs that level of accuracy in daily life, I'm not sure. But anyway, there you have it. But the thing is, there is no number you can dial on your phone to get the time from God's perspective. But the Bible tells us, and it tells us that in this macro sense, well, what we've been seeing in James, we don't know what tomorrow may bring. We know that life is short. We know that we're in the last days and that judgment is near. We know that the Lord is coming and that he's at the door. And so James is saying we need to be those who keep going in faith, who keep turning from worldliness, not living arrogantly as if we were in control, not living self-indulgently as if, you know, the person with the most toys wins. Lord Shaftesbury will be a name familiar to you, I'm sure, so the great English social reformer of the 19th century. There was a guy who was born into privilege. So his background was one of horses and shooting parties and stately waltzes in stately homes. He was an aristocrat. He was a noble. But he went on to dedicate his life to serving the poor, the oppressed, the exploited, and advancing the cause of foreign missions. And he was often opposed. He had a really hard time because he did this. Why did he do it? You know, he could have had such a comfortable life of ease and self-indulgence. Well, he was reported to have said this on one occasion: "I do not think that in the last 40 years I've ever lived one conscious hour that was not influenced by the thought of our Lord's return." And there was a guy who knew the time, and it made all the difference to his life and his priorities. By contrast, I was reading the blog of a couple called William and Catherine, No relation to the Mackenzies, who we know and love dearly in our church family. But this is a couple who are partway through the trip of a lifetime, sailing round the world at the moment. And one entry that caught my eye begins like this. Ship's log. Oh my goodness, we've lost track of time. When it happened, I have no idea. Each day rolls into the next, and where are we? Now that's fine if you're sailing for a few days off Tahiti, but spiritually that is a very dangerous condition to be in, spiritually. So to lose track of time, for each day to just start rolling into the next, to not know where you are, spiritually that spells disaster. And so may we be those who have a keen sense of time from God's perspective and whose lives are shaped by it.